Before we get into today's episode, I want to invite you on a unique spiritual journey this Advent season. It's called Journey to Bethlehem, and it's a free 9-day text message series designed to prepare your heart for Christmas. Starting on December the 17th, and each day leading up to Christmas, you'll receive a short reflective message pointing you to the hope, peace, joy, and love found in the coming of Christ. It's completely free and a great way to keep your focus on Jesus this season. Sign up today at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now here's today's podcast.
Provision is a new app made by Christians for Christians. It's designed to help you spend, save and give with greater purpose. You can link as many available UK bank accounts as you like and keep track of everything, simply in one place. Set reminders to pray when your regular giving goes out, or to give thanks when God provides. It's not about control. It's about making informed choices rooted in faith. Steward your money wisely with the new Provision app. Download now at provision.money and use code PREMIER to get your first month free. That's code PREMIER at provision.money.
Well, hello and welcome along to the programme Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. I do hope you're well. And I've got something really exciting for you today. This is, what you're listening to today, is a podcast-only edition of the programme. Only those who subscribe online, get the MP3, listen online at the webpage, etc., can hear today's programme. And that's because we're doing something a little bit longer than normal that wouldn't fit into the normal programme schedule. We're going to be airing a full debate that took place a few years ago between A.C. Grayling, who's an atheist professor in London, and Bill Craig, who is, more formally known as William Lane Craig, but he is one of the world's leading Christian philosophers and is research professor of philosophy at Talbot School of Theology. Well, before I get into an introduction into what they're talking about and why, let me say that exciting news. If you are a fan of William Lane Craig or like to see him in debate against atheists, what a treat we've got coming up for you in October here in the UK. We have the Reasonable Faith Tour coming up. It's being sponsored by Premier Christian Radio, Damaris and UCCF. And my programme, Unbelievable, we're going to be, if you like, hosting the first leg of the tour in London. And he's kicking off on Monday, the 17th of October, with a debate at Westminster Central Hall. And he's going to be debating Polly Toynbee, who is a noted journalist and a critic of religion and, of course, president of the British Humanist Association. So that's a fantastic way to get the tour off to a great start. And I'm pleased to tell you that we have now opened the ticket lines. You can actually book and buy your tickets for the tour. It's not just the London date. There's other dates that you can find. Now, if you want to see full details of the tour, the best place to go for that is the BeThinking website, bethinking.org/Craig, and you can see the full overview of the tour. If you want to go straight to the booking page, and there's a link to that from the BeThinking website, but if you want to go straight to the booking page for the tour, that's being hosted on Premier's website. That's premier.org.uk/Craig, premier.org.uk/Craig. So you can now buy tickets for the debate in Westminster in London for Polly Toynbee versus Bill Craig on the existence of God. There's also dates in Cambridge, the BeThinking National Apologetics Day conference coming up on the Saturday of that week that Bill's with us. A fabulous lineup of speakers for that conference in London. John Lennox will be there, Gary Habermas from the US, Peter J. Williams. That's all happening on Saturday, the 22nd of October. You can also book tickets for his lecture on Is God a Delusion? Responding to Dawkins' The God Delusion on the 25th of October. There's a debate in Manchester going on near the end of the tour where he'll be debating Dr. Peter Atkins, a well-known atheist scientist, on the question of whether God exists. And I'm pleased to be able to tell you that just confirmed before I came to record today's programme is that Bill will also be doing a date in Birmingham, and it's going to be another debate, this time against atheist philosopher Peter Millikan. And so that's a really interesting trio of debates that will be going on. And there's other lectures to be added to that schedule. So check back as well if you're interested in seeing more dates in the course of the next few weeks. But there's, if you like, three debates that will be taking place during the tour, starting with Polly Toynbee in London. That's on Monday the 17th of October. Then midway through the tour will be the date in Birmingham with Peter Millikan, atheist philosopher, and finishing up with atheist scientist Dr. Peter Atkins on the 26th of October in Manchester. Premier.org.uk/Craig to book your tickets now. And starting off on the Monday, if you want to come along in London, I'll be there, and it'll be a pleasure to welcome Polly Toynbee and William Lane Craig for that debate on the existence of God. We're making it as cheap as possible for students. That's going to be £5 only for students, and that is an absolutely blinder of a deal. We're cutting our own throats to make that happen. But normal tickets at £12.50. So if you're able to get online, I would urge you to do that now. OK, turning to today's discussion. Well, as part of this tour, we really wanted to have both Richard Dawkins and A.C. Grayling to have some kind of a debate with William Lane Craig, who is considered by many to be the foremost Christian defender of the faith in the world from the apologetics point of view. They've both refused. They've given a number of reasons. One of the reasons that A.C. Grayling gave when I invited him to do the debate, was that he said, "I'm not interested in debating Professor Craig. I'd be happy to debate him on the question of the existence of fairies and water nymphs, but as for the very uninteresting matter of whether there is just one god or goddess and that it can be debated, well, that's an empty prospect, hence my declining the invitation." Well, that was disappointing, obviously, that A.C. Grayling, who is one of the foremost philosophical atheists in the country, wasn't prepared to get into a debate on the existence of God. It seemed a little bit narrow-sighted, in my opinion. Nonetheless, it was strange then to read later on him being quoted on the Richard Dawkins website, where a thread developed on the whole the fact that Craig is coming over to the UK. And Dawkins quoted Grayling as saying, "Craig claims to have debated me before. That is not correct, unless you count a brief exchange of emails." Now, the strange thing about all this is that it's actually Grayling who's mistaken there. They did have a debate. And in fact, we're going to be hearing it today. They had a debate in 2005, no less at the Oxford Union, of all places. So quite a significant date to have slipped the memory of A.C. Grayling there. But anyway, bizarre memory slips aside, we are going to be hearing the debate that did take place on the existence of God between A.C. Grayling and William Lane Craig. That's what you're hearing today. As you'll recall, 2005 was shortly after the Boxing Day tsunami that happened and had such a devastating impact across various parts of Asia. And that is the context in which this debate was held. The debate title, "Belief in God Makes Sense in Light of Tsunamis." That was the debate subject. I should warn you that a little later on in the recording, it gets a little bit harder to make out some of what A.C. Grayling has to say. There was obviously some technical issue going on with microphones and where they were in relation to that. But I've tried to bring out the best of the audio as much as I possibly could. So you may have to listen a little bit more attentively towards the end when they're in the more conversational mode part of the debate. But here it is, William Lane Craig and A.C. Grayling debating whether God makes sense in light of tsunamis.
Now, let the debate begin. Please welcome our first speaker proposing the motion that belief in God is reasonable, Professor William Lane Craig.
Thank you, and good evening. I'm very grateful to the Oxford Union for the privilege of debating here this evening on this most important topic, and I thank you for your warm welcome. I'm also grateful as well for Professor Grayling's participation in the event this evening, and I trust that our discussion tonight will not only be an intellectual exercise for you, but will also be a significant help in your own personal spiritual journey. Now, when we ask whether belief in God makes sense in light of tsunamis, we're posing in a provocative way the problem that traditionally philosophers have called the problem of evil. This problem is undoubtedly the greatest obstacle to belief in God. When we consider the depth and the extent of suffering in the world, then it makes it hard to believe in God. Maybe we should just all become atheists. But that would be a pretty big step to take. How can we be sure that God does not exist? Maybe there's a reason why God permits all the suffering in the world. Maybe it all fits into some grand scheme of things that we can only dimly envision, if at all. How do we know? Well, despite the undeniable emotional impact of the problem of evil, I'm persuaded that as a strictly rational, intellectual problem, it does not constitute a disproof of the existence of God. Let me explain why. Traditionally, atheists have claimed that the coexistence of God and evil is logically impossible. That is to say, there is no possible world in which God and evil both exist. Since we know that evil exists, the argument goes, it follows logically that God does not exist. It is this version of the problem of evil that Professor Grayling recently defended in his debate with Keith Ward in The Prospect. So, according to the logical version of the problem of evil, the two statements on your handout, A, an omnipotent, omnibenevolent God exists, and B, evil exists, are logically incompatible. The difficulty for the atheist, however, is that statements A and B are not, at face value, logically inconsistent. There's no explicit contradiction between them. If the atheist thinks that they're implicitly contradictory, then he must be assuming some hidden premises that would serve to bring out the contradiction and make it explicit. But what are those premises? Well, the atheist seems to be assuming two things. One, if God is omnipotent, then he can create any world that he desires. And two, if God is omnibenevolent, then he prefers a world without evil over a world with evil. The atheist reasons that since God is omnipotent, he could create a world without evil, and since he is omnibenevolent, he would prefer a world without evil. Therefore, if God exists, evil cannot exist. This version of the problem of evil has been seriously undermined by the incisive critique of the philosopher Alvin Plantinga. Plantinga notes that the atheist must show that both of the critical assumptions, one and two, are necessarily true in order for the argument to be logically valid. But, Plantinga argues, if it is even possible that human beings have free will, then one and two are not necessarily true. Take assumption one. If free will is possible, then it's false that an omnipotent God can create just any world that he desires. God's being omnipotent does not imply that he can do logical impossibilities, such as make a round square or a married bachelor. But it is logically impossible to make someone freely choose to do something. Thus, if God grants people genuine freedom to choose as they like, then it's impossible for him to determine what their choices will be. All he can do is create the circumstances in which a person is able to make a free choice, and then, so to speak, stand back and let him make that choice. Now, what this implies is that there are worlds which are possible in and of themselves, but which God is incapable of creating. Philosophers say that such worlds are not feasible for God. So the first assumption made by the atheist, namely that an omnipotent God can create any world that he desires, is not necessarily true. Now, this is important because for all we know, in every feasible world where God creates free creatures, some of those creatures freely choose to do evil. Thus, it's possible that every world feasible for God, which contains free creatures, is a world with sin and evil. And therefore, the atheist's argument on this ground alone is invalid. But what about the second assumption? That if God is omnibenevolent, then he prefers a world without evil over a world with evil. Again, such an assumption is not necessarily true. The fact is that in many cases, we allow suffering to occur in a person's life because we have some morally sufficient reason for permitting it. I'm reminded of a remark once made by C.S. Lewis. What do people mean when they say, "I'm not afraid of God because I know that He is good"? Have they never even been to the dentist? God may permit suffering in our lives in order to achieve some morally sufficient overriding end. Thus, even though God is omnibenevolent, He might well have morally sufficient reasons for permitting pain and suffering in the world. Consequently, the second assumption of our atheist friends is also not necessarily true. The argument is thus doubly invalid. The bottom line is that atheists have not been able to show that either of their key assumptions is necessarily true, which they must do in order to sustain the claim that the coexistence of God and evil is logically impossible. The atheist who makes this claim has unwittingly shouldered a tremendously heavy burden of proof which no one has been able to sustain. Now, Plantinga argues that we can go even further than this. Not only has the atheist failed to prove that God and evil are inconsistent, but we can, on the contrary, prove that God and evil are consistent. In order to do so, all we have to do is provide some proposition that is compatible with God's existence and which entails that evil exists. And the following is such a proposition on your handout. C. God could not have created a world that had so much good as the actual world, but had less evil, both in terms of quantity and quality, and moreover, God has morally sufficient reasons for permitting the evil that exists. So long as this proposition is even possible, it shows that God and the evil in the world are logically compatible. In summary, the atheist who champions the logical version of the problem of evil bears the burden of proof to show that there is no possible world in which A and B are true. That is an enormously heavy burden which has proved to be unsustainable. After centuries of discussion, contemporary philosophers, including virtually all atheists and agnostics, have come to admit that the logical problem of evil has been solved. In the words of the prominent philosopher William Alston, it is now acknowledged on almost all sides that the logical argument from evil is bankrupt. Now, perhaps Professor Grayling would retreat at this point to the position that while the coexistence of God and evil are logically possible, nonetheless, it's highly improbable. So given the evil in the world, it's improbable that God exists. This probabilistic version of the problem, however, faces insuperable difficulties. Let me just mention three this evening. Number one, we're not in a position to assess inductively the probability that God lacks morally sufficient reasons for permitting the evils that occur. The atheist seems to think that if God has morally sufficient reasons for permitting the evils that occur, then these reasons should be obvious to us. But there's absolutely no grounds for that assumption. The transcendent God sees the end of history from its beginning and providentially orders history so that His purposes are ultimately achieved through human free decisions. In order to achieve His ends, God may well have to put up with various evils along the way, evils which appear pointless or unnecessary to us within our limited frame of reference, may be seen to have been justly permitted within God's wider frame of reference. We simply have no idea of the natural and moral evils that might be involved in order for God to arrange the circumstances and free agents in them necessary to some intended purpose. Nor can we always discern the reasons why such a provident God might have for permitting some evil to enter our lives. To say this is not to appeal to mystery, but rather to point to the inherent cognitive limitations that frustrate attempts to say on inductive grounds that it's improbable that God has a morally sufficient reason for permitting some particular evil. Ironically, in other contexts, atheists recognize these cognitive limitations. One of the most damaging objections to utilitarian ethical theory which says that we should always act so as to maximize the greatest happiness for the greatest number of people, is that it is quite simply impossible for us to estimate which action we might perform will ultimately lead to the greatest amount of happiness in the world. Because of our cognitive limitations, actions which appear disastrous in the short term may redound to the greatest good, while some short-term boon may prove to issue in untold misery. Once we contemplate God's providence over the whole of history, then it becomes evident how hopeless it is for limited observers to speculate on the probability of God's having morally sufficient reasons for the evils that we see. We're simply not in a good position to assess such probabilities with any confidence. Secondly, Christian theism entails doctrines that increase the probability of the coexistence of God and evil. The atheist maintains that if God exists, then it's improbable that the world would contain the evil it does. But if the biblical God exists, then it's not in fact so surprising that evil exists. Thus, evil is not so improbable on Christian theism. For according to Christian theism, the chief purpose of life is not happiness, but rather the knowledge of God. One reason the problem of evil seems so difficult is that people naturally tend to assume that if God exists, then his purpose for human life is happiness in this life. God's role is to provide a comfortable environment for his human pets. But on the Christian view, this is false. We are not God's pets, and the goal of human life is not happiness, per se, but rather the knowledge of God, which in the end will bring true and everlasting human fulfillment. Many evils occur in life which may be utterly pointless with respect to the goal of producing human happiness, but they may not be pointless with respect to producing a deeper knowledge of God. Because God's ultimate goal for humanity is the knowledge of himself, which alone can bring eternal happiness to people, history cannot be seen in its true perspective apart from considerations pertinent to the kingdom of God. It may well be the case that natural and moral evils are part of the means God uses to draw people into his eternal kingdom. Moreover, God's purpose is not restricted to this life, but spills over beyond the grave into eternal life. When God asks his children to bear horrible suffering in this life, it is only with the prospect of a heavenly joy and recompense that is beyond all comprehension. And the longer we spend in eternity, the more the sufferings of this life shrink by comparison to an infinitesimal moment. The person in heaven looking back would say, no matter how awful his pain, no matter what he suffered, I would go through it a million times over to know this joy. Thus, if Christian theism is true, the existence of evil is not so improbable. Number three, relative to the full scope of the evidence, God's existence is probable. Probabilities are relative to one's background information. Thus, with a probability argument, we always need to ask, probable with respect to what? Now, apply this principle to the probabilistic problem of evil. The atheist says God's existence is improbable. But with respect to what? To the evil in the world? Well, if that's all you consider for your background information, then I think it's hardly surprising that God's existence would appear improbable relative to that alone. But that's not the interesting question. The interesting question is whether God's existence is improbable relative to the full scope of the evidence. And the Christian theist will insist that we consider not just the evil in the world, but rather all the evidence relevant to God's existence. Now, obviously, I don't have time to discuss it here, but in my published work, I've written extensively in defense of various arguments for the existence of God. I'm convinced that even given any improbability that evil throws upon God's existence is still quite probable on the basis of the evidence. In any case, it would be premature to conclude that God's existence is improbable unless one has thoroughly examined and weighed all the relevant evidence. In conclusion, then, neither the logical nor the probabilistic problem of evil constitutes a justification of atheism. The rational man is well within his rights in thinking that the existence of God makes sense, even in light of tsunamis.
before we began our debate, I said to Professor Crabbe that I was prepared to concede the victory this evening to him in the matter of ties. He's got a much more handsome tie than I've got. I wore this one because as the token or what a theist would call an atheist, although because I also don't believe in fairies and so on, I prefer to be called an atheist. I thought I'd better wear a sort of fairly sober tie in order to appear to be a bit more respectable than I am. But I'm tremendously impressed, by the way, at the number of you present here on a Friday evening in Oxford. I think things must have changed since I was an undergraduate. Yeah, there must be fewer facilities. But at any rate, I'm delighted to see you all. Let me just begin with a remark about the tsunami, which, as you know, killed several hundred thousand people, among them small children and elderly people. A great majority of them were not Christians. They were people of other faiths and all faiths, I suppose, and of no faith. So I suppose one would need an assumption to the effect that the deity, if he, she, or it caused it or countenanced it or wasn't able to stop it, nevertheless it would have in some sense to be the same deity for all those people. And if there is a greater good envisaged in the event, then it would have to be one that is somehow captured in very different forms in these different faiths. And I leave that point hanging in the air because I think it's something that we need to bring up a bit later on, remembering that there is a competition between the faiths. After all, a Christian will tell you that the founder of that religion said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father but by me." It seems rather bad news for very many of the people who were swept away by that great wave. Still, let's begin at the beginning. We have to wade our way through a number of ifs before we get to the point that we need to discuss tonight. If there are supernatural entities or phenomena in the universe, and by that I mean things that don't fall into the category of frogs and clouds and galaxies and human beings and so on, subject to description in terms of natural laws and the rest. So if there are supernatural entities or phenomena in the universe, and if these supernatural phenomena are in some way active, if they're agents, and that's just a grammatical simplicity, talk in terms of one such thing, call it X for the moment. If X is an agent, that is, can do things and in some way react to the facts in the universe. And if further that supernatural entity is not merely an agent, but also an intelligent one, has intelligence, and if, yet again, it's not merely intelligent, but also interested in this bit of the universe with the people in it, then we need to ask ourselves the question, what, if anything, can be inferred about the nature of such an entity, if we allow ourselves so many ifs, from the evidence that we have available to us? So if there's a supernatural entity which is intelligent and interested in this bit of the universe, what can we say about what that entity might be like? On the basis of what the world seems like to us. And we're remembering here that the evidence includes tsunamis and childhood cancers and things like that. And the answer would have to be something like this. At first blush, at any rate, before the theologians get to work on us, it would seem that that intelligent and interested agency in the universe would have to be either malevolent or, if not impotent, then only quasi-potent. Okay, so malevolent we could understand. In fact, the Old Testament is full of suggestions that if you were a Midianite or someone like that, then the deity might indeed be reasonably malevolent towards you. So, but if not malevolent, then not omnipotent, because constrained in some way in its power to lessen the suffering that is experienced by the creation with which it stands in some relation. Now, the answer to that second point is to say, well, maybe it is benevolent, but its omnipotence is not exercised in a way that would ensure a reduction of the amount of suffering that there is in the universe, because it has a purpose, a greater purpose that the suffering should in some way subserve. Now, both those points were made by Professor Crabbe in his presentation, and he was talking about the hidden assumptions made by the person who doesn't believe in fairies and so on. If God is omnipotent, he can create any world that he desires, and he disputed that assumption, and that's the point that I just raised about quasi-potence or lack of potency. And the second one about God's benevolence, that if God is omnibenevolent, he prefers a world in which evil doesn't exist. And he raised the point in connection with that too. And you will notice that the points actually don't sit quite consistently with one another, because the answer that he gave to the first point is, so God is not quite omnipotent, because there are some things that he can't do. For example, he can't do logically impossible things, or we know that already because he can't eat himself for breakfast and that kind of thing. But what he also can't do is to create a world which has free will in it, required, incidentally, so that we can answer problems about the existence of moral evil in the world, remembering that if there is a God who is the creator of the world and is responsible ultimately for everything that happens in it, then he's responsible for murder and rape and the rest of it. And so in order to block that consequence, we have to think in terms of creation, parts of the creation in a way, that's us having free will. So he's not quite omnipotent. There's a derogation from that point. But as to the omnibenevolence, well, he's willing to let suffering occur in the world for a greater good. And that if only we could see sub specie aeternitatis what that greater good is, then no matter how great the suffering, say of grief, of loss, of terror, of being faced with an unkind or cruel nature, no matter what the experience of suffering might be, nevertheless it subserves some greater good. And we can't see what that is because we have finite minds. Now, I just mentioned in passing, to lead to one side of the discussion, the thought that invoking the finitude of our cognitive powers, and our inability to see what that greater good might be, is, as it seems to me, a very helpful and convenient argument for the theologian, because once one pulls the curtain of mystery across things, then of course one can say and believe anything. But the inconsistency between the two points is this. If you derogate somewhat from God's omnipotence, then you're in effect saying that, well, he can't, in a world which contains free will agents and so on, he can't have prevented the degree of suffering that is present in the world. The second point, he's nevertheless willing to let suffering occur for a greater good. So if you think that suffering is necessary for a greater good, then, and you permit it to happen, then the implication seems to be that you could do something about not letting it happen, but since you've got this greater good in mind, you do let it happen. So what one wants to say to the theologian is, well, which do you want? Do you want him to be not quite omnipotent, or do you want him to be omnipotent but willing to let suffering happen so that a greater good can ensue? Which of those two things do you want? Now, I think that the response that one has to make to at least the second of those two points is this. Either we are created in God's image, so it is written somewhere, or much more probably, we create God in our own image. And so our thought of what to expect or to believe about an agency which is intelligent and interested in a world like ours would have to be derived in some way from our own experience of relationship with others. And the one that provides us with most materials is the experience of fatherhood. I'm a father, and I'm rather fond of my children. Occasionally they are of me also. And I sometimes wonder to myself just how much suffering I would subject them to for the greater good that I see, but they don't, for their lives. I'm not sure that going to the dentist is quite comparable with being drowned in a tsunami, but I am quite confident that I wouldn't drown any of them in a tsunami, however annoying they can sometimes occasionally be, in the hope that it might teach them a lesson or stop me from being irritated in future or some greater good of that kind. So from my own experience of fatherhood, I'm very puzzled by the thought that there could be an interested and intelligent being whose interest wasn't malevolent, even just a neutral sort of interest, conscious of the fact that we have emotions and sensations, emotions of fear, sensations of pain as possibilities, emotions of joy and sensations of pleasure as possibilities, and thinking with respect to them, especially if you had some responsibility for them, thinking that nevertheless you could subject them even to the most extreme of challenges to their emotional and physical sensory well-being in the hope that some greater good would thereby be subserved. And the reason why I think that seems a deeply suspicious move to make on the part of theologians is that it takes us back to the point about the alleged omnipotence of God. If God is omnipotent, then he could create a world which has free-willed beings in it and which doesn't have pain and suffering in it. What's the logical inconsistency there? What the theologian has to argue in response to that point is that the world could not, and it is the strength of the modality there that actually occurs in statement C, that God could not have created a world with as much good as this world contains unless it contained the degree of evil, of natural evil that it has in it. Now, why should one accept that? If one accepts that God is genuinely omnipotent, then he could create a world which maximizes the good and minimizes or perhaps dispenses altogether with pain and suffering. One could imagine, for example, him creating a world which was entirely intellectual. After all, although many of our agonies are intellectual ones, I mean, some of us coming up to schools in 4 weeks' time and being subjected at the moment to the most terrible intellectual cruelties, most of the suffering that people think of in the world tends to take the form of physical suffering. So we think about deprivation at one end, and at the other end, the excruciating pain of certain kinds of illnesses, or the terrible emotional pain of grief and loss and fear. Why is it that those things should be essentially required for a world to have as much good in it as this one does? Or arguably, of course, this world doesn't contain as much good in it as there could be, given that the quantum of suffering in the world is as it is. Remember this also, that some of the natural evils that occur in the world do so as a result of our agency, for example, our effect on the environment, and our spreading of diseases one to another, and the rest. And so that there is a complex relationship between the two kinds of evil that there are in the world, moral and natural. And if the natural evil that exists in the world is somehow willed by a deity for a greater good, then the instrumental action of moral evil in the world would have to be willed by that deity too, and wouldn't just be an artifact of having free will. So my thought is this. Once you have taken the long route through a whole series of suppositions, thinking that the world might contain a certain sort of entity, and this entity might have the right kind of character to understand and appreciate our emotional and sensational lives, and might be interested in some way in those emotions and sensations, then the question, if you really, really wanted to accept that view, then the question arises with great urgency as to what kind of being that could be, consistently with the way the world in fact is. And it's very interesting to notice that in the development of thinking about the relationship that individual human beings have with their world, with a world containing the possibilities of suffering and the rest, there have been dramatically different conceptions of that relationship. For example, in the medieval period, contemptus mundi literature was a great feature. The Da Vinci Code of the day was the book that told you that the world is a vale of tears and suffering, and that all you have to do is endure and pay your tithes, and you would eventually get to heaven. And what followed that period in the Renaissance was a rediscovery of the joy and the beauty of the world and the possibility of the pleasure in the world, and a refocusing of attention by human beings on things that are imminent, things that are here in the world, and a desire to maximize the pleasure and the enjoyment that came from understanding that world, from appreciating the beauties in it, and from adding to them. A world, in other words, where the good was conceived as lying in things that spoke to the emotions and the sensations of human beings. Well, according to a theory which has it that suffering is some part of the production of the greater good, there would have to be questions asked about the degree of consistency between the conception that the Renaissance thinkers had about the good and that conception about the need that the world has for there to be suffering and pain in it. And anybody who takes the sort of position that I do is very skeptical about the idea that there are supernatural agencies intelligent enough and interested enough in us to know about us that we can suffer and enjoy, that we can feel fear and that we can feel joy. Anybody, any being who had that conception of us would have to be quite conscious of the effect that its agency had in respect of what we regard as being in our interests and for our good. So when we pose the question, is it reasonable to believe that there could be a deity? And I think, you know, the concept of God is a very capacious one and has to do with a great number of different traditions and definitions of what such a being could be. But when we ask that question, generally speaking, we think of almighty and all-loving deity. And can it be reasonable to think that the universe is governed by, even contains such a thing? And I think the answer has to be not. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Grayling, for those interesting remarks in response to my opening statement. You'll remember that I distinguish between two versions of the problem of evil, the logical version and the probabilistic version, and I suggested that the logical version is no longer defended today, that it has been given up because it's been recognized that the atheist cannot sustain the enormous burden of proof this involves. But so far as I could understand Professor Grayling's position in his opening speech, he's sticking by the logical version of the problem of evil. Despite that, he's going to maintain it. Now, he said that looking at the world, we would conclude the deity must be either impotent or malevolent. But to say that is to assume precisely those two hidden assumptions, namely that if God is omnipotent, he can create any world that he desires, and if he's omnibenevolent, he would prefer a world without evil over a world with evil. And so if the response is not to be question-begging, we need to see some argument on behalf of those two premises. And you remember I suggested that those cannot be proved. First, if free will is even possible, it follows that an omnipotent God cannot create every world that he might desire. Now, Professor Grayling responded by saying, well, Dr. Craig, you're qualifying divine omnipotence. On your view, God is not quite omnipotent. And I want to protest against that and say that's not at all accurate. Historically, divine omnipotence has always been defined in terms of God's ability to do whatever is logically possible. The only philosopher that I know of who thought God could do logical impossibilities was René Descartes. But everyone else has always said omnipotence means the ability to do whatever is logically possible. But God's inability to make a round square or a married bachelor is not an inability on God's part, because there is no such thing as a round square or a married bachelor. Those are just self-contradictory combinations of words that have no referent. So God can do anything that is logically possible. And as I say, it is logically impossible to make someone freely do something. And I don't think that Professor Grayling grasped the difference between a possible world and a feasible world. There are possible worlds, logically, where everyone always chooses to do the right thing. But those worlds may not be feasible for God, because if God created the agents in them, in the circumstances envisioned, the agents might choose differently, might go the wrong way. So that given that it's logically impossible to make someone freely choose to do something, not every logically possible world is actualizable by God, only feasible worlds. And therefore, this is no qualification of divine omnipotence to say there are worlds that God is incapable of creating. Now, if you do want to go with Descartes and say, well, God's omnipotence means he can do the logical impossible, well, then there's no problem with evil at all, because God can bring it about that he exists and that evil exists, even though these are logically incompatible with each other. So if you go that route, you've completely dissolved any problem of evil. Now, what about the second assumption, that God prefers a world over evil, without evil, over a world with evil? And I suggested that if we have morally sufficient reasons for permitting pain and suffering, then sometimes we do allow it. Now, here, Professor Grayling says, but a father wouldn't allow his children to suffer so terribly. I want to say a couple of things here. First, the father analogy is terribly misleading. We must not compare God to a human father when it comes to moral responsibility, because they are so different. God, we have a moral obligation to worship God, but any human father who demanded worship from his children would be egomaniacal. So that the relationship between a child and his human father is completely different from our moral obligations toward God. Moreover, a human father doesn't have certain rights vis-a-vis his child that God has toward us. God is our creator and sustainer, the author and giver of life. A human father doesn't have the right to take the life of his own child. But if God wanted to take my life this evening, that's his prerogative. It is in his hands when I live and when I die. So the moral obligations between a father and his child are utterly different from God's relationship with us. But in any case, the point remains unrefuted. Even the human father will sometimes permit suffering in the life of his child because of a morally sufficient overriding reason. He wouldn't permit perhaps terrible suffering, but if he has a morally sufficient reason, he'll permit it. And it is possible that God could have morally sufficient reasons for permitting horrible and terrible suffering in this world. And as long as that's even possible, the atheist has failed to shoulder the burden of proof to show that this second assumption is true. And it's so important for us to remember here, it's not the theist who bears the burden of proof here. It's the atheist who is claiming that A and B are logically incompatible. It's the atheist who bears the burden of proof to show that these hidden assumptions are true. All I have to do is simply undercut them by saying, well, it's possible that they're not true. The atheist must prove they're necessarily true, and until he does that, he can't carry his case. But remember, I said we can go a step further. We can actually prove that A and B are logically compatible with each other on the basis of C. C doesn't even need to be true. As long as it's just possibly true, it proves that there is a possible world in which God and evil coexist. And I didn't hear any response from Professor Grayling to that point. In short, the logical problem of evil is just not defended anymore in the philosophical community. Peter Van Inwagen, in the Philosophical Perspectives of 1991, writes, "It used to be widely held that evil was incompatible with the existence of God, that no possible world contained both God and evil. So far as I am able to tell, this thesis is no longer defended." So let me just simply, in the interest of debate, go on to the probabilistic problem, even though Professor Grayling didn't discuss it. I suggested three reasons that the probabilistic problem of evil faces insuperable difficulties. First, that we're not in a good position to assess these probabilities inductively. In a very important article in Philosophical Perspectives of 1991, William Alston, in a classic article on the evidential problem of evil, lists six cognitive limits on us that make it in principle impossible for us to judge that God does not have morally sufficient reasons for permitting the evil in the world. Let me list these. Number one, lack of data. Our ignorance of the distant future or the distant past, our ignorance of the ultimate constitution of the universe, the secrets of the human heart. Two, complexity greater than we can handle. For example, trying to understand different systems of natural law and which different laws of nature operate. We have no clue about what systems are available to God. Two, the difficulty of knowing what is metaphysically possible. How do we know what logically imaginable worlds are actually metaphysically possible? Four, our ignorance of the full range of possibilities. We don't know how these are restricted. Five, our ignorance of the full range of values. That is to say, there may be unknown goods that God brings about that we are not even aware of. And six, the limits of our capacity to make well-considered value judgments. That is to say, to be able to compare different possible worlds with a view toward determining which world would be the best. Now, in my opening speech, I gave an illustration of just one of those cognitive limits, namely our lack of data. And I illustrated this from utilitarianism. We have no idea when an action is performed whether it will ultimately produce great happiness or great disaster, and therefore utilitarianism is wrong in saying that an action is right or wrong based on its consequences, because we don't know the ultimate consequences. But let me give another example from the current science. In chaos theory, scientists have been able to show that certain macroscopic systems are highly sensitive to the tiniest perturbations. The flutter of a butterfly's wing in a jungle in West Africa can set in motion forces that will eventually issue in a hurricane over the Atlantic Ocean. And yet no one looking at that little butterfly would be able, even in principle, to predict such an outcome. Another example from popular culture. In the movie Sliding Doors with Gwyneth Paltrow, we see how a young woman is rushing into the underground to catch a subway train. And just as she approaches the train, the doors begin to slide shut. At that point, the film splits in two. And one half of the film narrates her life as it would have happened if she had made it through the doors. The other half of the film shows what would happen to her if the doors closed before she got there. And what's interesting in this film is the one life turns into happiness, success, everything she does is great, whereas the other life goes from bad to worse, disaster, failure, misery, all because of this one seemingly trivial incident of catching those sliding doors. Moreover, whether she got through those sliding doors was based upon whether her path was momentarily blocked on the steps by a little girl playing with her dolly on the handrail. And of course, what the movie doesn't show is that little girl's playing with the dolly on the handrail was also contingent upon, for example, how quickly she buttoned her blouse when dressing for school that morning, or how much muesli her mother put in the bowl, how long it would take to eat breakfast, or whether her father had to stop to tie a shoe on the way into the underground. You begin to see that these contingencies result in simply unpredictable situations. But here's the really interesting part of the film, is the shock ending. At the end of the movie, you suddenly discover that in the life in which everything is going hunky-dory and just super, she's suddenly killed in a car accident, and her life comes to an end. Whereas in the miserable, unhappy life, that life turns around, and it turns out that that is the really good life after all. This illustrates, I think, so pointedly how we're simply not in a position to judge when things come into our life that God doesn't have a morally sufficient reason for permitting it. William Austin concludes, we are simply not in a position to justifiably assert that God would have no sufficient reason for permitting evil. And if that is right, the probabilistic argument from evil is in no better shape than its late, lamented, logical cousin. Second, I suggested that Christian theism increases the probability of God and evil in the world because God's purpose in the world is not happiness, but the knowledge of himself to bring people freely to salvation. Well, how's God doing on this job? In 1990, some fascinating statistics were released from the U.S. Center for World Mission, plotting the number of committed Christians in the world toward non-Christians in the world. In the year AD 100, there were 360 non-Christians for every committed Christian in the world. By AD 1000, there were 220 non-Christians per committed Christian in the world. By 1900, there were 27 non-Christians for every committed Christian in the world. By 1989, there were only 7 non-Christians for every committed Christian in the world. God is building his kingdom down through history. And it is not at all improbable that natural and moral evils are part of the means which he uses to bring people into his kingdom and to give them eternal life and everlasting happiness, in comparison to which the sufferings of this life will diminish to infinitesimal proportions.
Thank you for that, and thank you to Professor Craig, too. It's a very, very long time since I've heard a sermon. My first point is that one always finds oneself in a difficulty in this kind of the situation in which I find myself at the moment, being someone who is the token atheist here. Because I begin by saying, okay, just suppose there's a profoundly improbable, idea that there is some being out there in the universe that has these properties of being, interested in us and aware and understands our situations. Just suppose that there is such a being, and he loves us and is our father and all the rest of it. Then I find, when I have debates with theologians, that that's not what's meant at all. In fact, the goalpost, the divine goalpost, keeps moving. Every time you say anything about this, what such a being would have to be like, you find that that's not what's meant. So when I say, we either create God in our image or he creates us in his image, then our best understanding of what that relationship would be, the creator who cares about us and all that, is a sort of fatherly relationship. So I, as a father, tend not to drown my children all that often and so on. That attempt to try to get some grip on the moral realities here, I find is a misleading analogy. So we flounder because the goalposts do move all the time. But still, let's do our best.
possible, a logically possible world may not be a feasible world. But I can understand that a logically possible world might not be a desirable world. It could be logically possible that God could be a God, and that God could create free will beings, and also that there's no natural evil in that world. But Professor Craig says that that's not feasible for God. This is like a jigsaw puzzle, because I've got to keep several pieces going at the same time. I have to remember that we don't have a great deal of knowledge about God's nature, so bear that in mind. But we know enough to know that it's not feasible for God's purposes, that although there's a logically possible world in which there is free will but no natural evil, that's not feasible for God. Although I find the distinction between logical possibility and feasibility so fine and subtle a one that I don't actually see it. I can see a distinction between logical possibility and desirability, but I don't see the difference between possibility and feasibility. Then Professor Gage talked about God having morally sufficient reasons for suffering. That's a fine-sounding phrase, morally sufficient reasons for suffering. Even if we don't know what it is, and we're here once again behind the veil of ignorance, nevertheless, we could take on trust the thought of being drowned in a tsunami or dying of painful of cancer or something would be good for us in some way. But we don't know what way that is, and then we just simply have to believe it. But remember that the discussion we're having at the moment is it reasonable for us to believe that in a world which contains tsunamis and childhood cancers and the rest, that there could be a being at least of great power and at least of who understands and has some concern for our feelings and attitudes and so on, whether it's reasonable to believe that there could be such a being. And I'm suggesting that there's a kind of incoherence in the idea of a being anything like the traditional attributes of God and a world of the kind that we do in fact occupy. Professor Craig says that there are three shortcomings to the probabilistic version of the argument from evil. And by the way, I should just mention that Professor Craig says that the current authorities in the field say that nobody now takes the logical problem of evil seriously. Well, long before that happened, people had stopped taking seriously the argument from authority, which is, as you know, a logical fallacy. So the fact that the theologians are not taking the argument seriously doesn't seem to me a refutation of it. But having left that one aside, the probabilistic problem of evil. We're not in a position to assess inductively the probability, etc., etc. So this is an appeal to our finitude and our ignorance. So we don't know what those morally sufficient reasons would be. The second point, Christian theism entails doctrines that increase the probability of the coexistence of God and evil. But as I say, if you're going to look at it from a Christian perspective, if you look at it from the point of view of the canonical Gospels, where we are told that God is almighty, that he is our Father, we say, our Father, in heaven and so on, that he can do all things, that he cares about the least sparrow. He also says, by the way, also for those of you about to do schools, take no thought for tomorrow, you can have to revise and so on. He says all these very comforting things, which give us, if we're going to start from a Christian perspective at any rate, a picture of the deity wholly inconsistent with the idea of natural evil in the world, unless we except that there is some enormously greater good that's going to be subserved by some of these terrible sufferings that are experienced in this world, and that we're just going to have to take on trust the fact that there is that greater good, but we don't know what it is. And finally, Professor Craig says that relative to the full scope of the evidence, not just the evidence of evil in the world, but to all the evidence that there is, that God's existence is probable. I would have thought that taking the full scope of the evidence into account about this world of ours would have made the probability that there is a supernatural being of some kind in this universe infinitesimally small. One last thing. Professor Craig talks about the defeater of the utilitarian argument residing in the fact that we don't really know what the ultimate consequences are going to be of our actions. I can know what the medium-term consequences are going to be, the difference between giving you an ice cream and kicking you on the ankle. I can tell that the one is going to probably be more pleasant for you than the other. So, generally speaking, of course, when we're being utilitarian about our actions, we go by our best lights and by what's most likely in the course of our experience and so on. And what one doesn't want to do is to suffer paralysis of moral action by butterfly effect. He said, I thought, just about to do something, just about to give you an ice cream, and I think to myself, God, I better not do that, because the this could cause a storm over the Atlantic, or, you know, some great disaster will happen. And, you know, everything is so contingent that you best not do anything at all. Well, of course, the fact of the matter is that in this world of ours, our understanding of human nature and the human condition is pretty rich and good on the whole for all our purposes. Remember what John Locke said in the preface to his essay. He said that the light that is set up in us shines bright enough for all our purposes. And generally speaking, as I say, we're much more confident that ice creams are better than kicks on the ankle. So from that point of view, I think our grasp of moral realities is extendable to this idea, this debate that we're having about whether it's reasonable to think that a world such as ours might have something that rather blurrily approximates to one or another of the conceptions of a deity, even though it's very hard to pin down just quite what that might be. This is not intended to be a commercial break, but I might just mention a recent book of mine in which I set forward an argument, among other arguments, about these matters, where I talk about the perfumed smokescreen which lies between the ordinary believer who goes to church and is told that God is a father and cares for you and he holds you in his hand and you need have no fear and that all is for the best in this, indeed, best of all possible worlds, as we're told. And the theological sophistication, in those senses of the term, of the arguments which try to show us that despite appearances, despite the facts, despite the realities of our existence in this world and our confrontation with how hard and harsh the world can be, nevertheless, fundamentally and ultimately, it's all for our good. Professor Craig said that from the point of view of Christian theology, happiness is not the point. The point is not for you to be happy, at least in this life. There is a posthumous dispensation in which you will know ultimate satisfaction and fulfillment and joy. So there is a blank check. Just if you can endure, if you can accept, if you will keep your faith despite the contrary evidence, then you can have a reasonable hope that in this future dispensation you will be happy. So happiness is the ultimate end, although it's not our happiness. It's not a happiness of ice creams and sunshine, but, not sure what it might be, endless hymn singing, or some alternative at any rate to what we normally take to be the happiness in this world. But I think, remember that our point is about reasonableness. It's not my task, as someone who doesn't believe in the existence of supernatural agencies in the universe, to disprove the existence of such things. That's not my task. Nor is it my task to prove that the universe is only a natural realm. My task is merely to say that on any of the traditional understandings of the notion of a deity or such a supernatural being, even the most minimal one, which just requires of it that it have the degree of insight and of appreciation of our perspective of things, that is it reasonable to believe that there could be such a being, and also that such a being could have any influence at all on what happens to creatures like us in this universe? Is it reasonable to believe in such a being consistently with the facts of the world as they are around us? And I say not. But remember that again, to take a cue from Professor Craig there, that's a point made about the existence of natural evil in the world, but one could generalize it and say from the point of view of the total scope of the evidence, the reasonableness of believing such a thing diminishes to zero. Thank you.
Thinking of questions, and as I say, we'll try and take three questions together, and then we'll open up a dialogue between the two. So when you give your questions, will you speak really loudly so we can pick them up, and then I'll try and repeat them and make sure we've got them. So first one here, back there at the right, and the middle, the second row there. Yes. Okay. Excellent questions to start with. I think this is going to be a very good discussion. So the first question was about the free will being important and how that reflects in the logical problem of natural evil. The second was about the burden of proof. Are you innocent and proved guilty, or guilty and proved innocent with respect to God? And thirdly, the actual question about do we have free will and can it be proved? Who'd like to open up?
I think the question about the burden of proof is the first one that needs to be tackled, because that's the most fundamental. Anyone who makes an assertion or a truth claim that he claims to know is making a claim to knowledge. Now, traditionally, knowledge has been defined as justified true belief. So if you make a claim to know something, you need to have some sort of justification for believing that. So if the atheist is claiming, with respect to the logical problem of evil, that these two propositions, A and B, are logically inconsistent, then he has the burden of proof to show that, because they're not logically inconsistent, prima facie, on their face. One is not the negation of the other. So if he's saying they're implicitly contradictory, then he must be making these hidden assumptions. Now, in order for A and B to be logically incompatible, these hidden assumptions have to be true in every possible world. And so, as I say, there is an enormous burden of proof that the atheist has to bear here. When I suggest C as a proof that they are compatible, this is a supererogatory act that the theist isn't called upon to do. The theist can simply rest with neutrality, that no inconsistency has been proved, and can just simply sit back. But if the theist wants to go further and say, yes, they are compatible, then he needs to come up with something like C as a means of showing the compatibility of A and B. So I tried to bear my share of the burden of proof tonight, and the atheist needs to bear his share too.
But would you accept that,
Well, on the question of burden of proof, no, because as I see it, the question is the rationality of thinking that a concept applies to something. Is it rational to think that there might be something to answer, that answers to the concept of a deity somehow easily defined? That I take to be the point of the occasion tonight, and I take it that we're not in the business of proving or disproving the existence of a deity, we're just asking whether if there were some such thing, it would be consistent with the existence of that human being. And so far as the point goes concerning the alleged by the atheist, the same points, the same strategy that we adopted there as is adopted by Kant in particular reasoning in our letter from here comes out in this, which is get a suitable definition of the terms in the apparent contradiction, the contradiction is resolved. And so that's my difficulty, because my difficulty there is that I don't have a clear conception of what it is that God is, that omnipotence is, that omnibenevolence is, but by means of which you can escape the problem posed by asking, is it rational to think that there could be a being, vaguely speaking, that is interested in concerning us, consistently with the natural world?
Now, I think it's important to see that these are distinct questions. When you start talking about is it rational, is it reasonable belief, then you, I think, move to the probabilistic version. In terms of the logical version, we're talking about whether or not a person who affirms these two propositions is incoherent. Is he somebody who, like, believes in a round square or a married bachelor? And if the atheist wants to say that he is, then the atheist needs to prove that there is a contradiction there. And this has been typically what atheists have tried to do. The late J.L. Mackey, as you know, here at Oxford University, tried to press this logical version of the problem of evil, and it was his work that really evoked Alvin Plantinga's free will defense. And I think Plantinga has really successfully shown that no atheist is able to bear so heavy a burden of proof, and that's why the debate has moved into this other question: is it reasonable, as you put it, is it rational to think that a good and omnipotent being exists in light of the evil?
There's a video, in fact, of J.L. Mackey and Alvin Plantinga walking very slowly up and down the lawn of the Fellows Garden University of in parallel lines. There's no parallel lines there, neither with Mackey nor Plantinga, because it was evident that they were talking about quite different conceptions of omnipotence. And I think that is the difficulty here. What the theist wants is not going to give up the idea that the deity is omnipotent, which is the strategy that he's always been talking about.
Right, and I wouldn't, I'm not taking that route, no.
You don't want that. So you've got to have a conception of omnipotence, which nevertheless, there are things that God can't do. That's the trick.
Yeah, well, now see, we need to be careful because things like things like a square circle, a married bachelor, a round triangle, aren't really things. So I do think God can do anything, but these are not things. They're just combinations of words that have no referent. So I'm sticking with the classical conception of omnipotence that has been enunciated by Thomas Aquinas, St. Anselm, and all the rest. I'm not backing away as some of these modern theologians do. On the contrary, but if you are wanting to go with this very strong Cartesian definition of omnipotence, where God can do logical impossibilities, then there just isn't any problem of evil because he can do logical contradictions.
Yeah, no, I agree with you there. I don't think that it's reasonable to expect that a God is only omnipotent if he can make green see furiously, let's say.
Uh-huh.
If it's just a matter of terminology, it doesn't think of God. I mean, plenty of women have turned bachelors into married men, so that's a different thing.
Right.
But I think if we were to take a more substantive example of what would be possible or impossible for an omnipotent deity rather than just a diplomatical example, and I think the round square is like an idea, then you, I think, would have to respond to the thought that if it's logically possible that there should be a world containing three individuals and where there is no natural evil, if that's logically possible, then the point that you make about it should not be feasible for God carries the weight of the argument. Now, you have to
say it again.
You have to give us an account of why it would not be feasible for God to create a world in which there is both free will and an absence of natural evil.
Yeah.
Given that that's logically possible.
Yeah. I don't seem to think that there's any reason to think that that would be infeasible, to have a world of free will without natural evil. See, that's difficult. Now, it might be infeasible because it might be that in any worlds of free creatures in which there is no natural evil, some of these creatures go wrong. And so you have moral evil in those worlds. And so if there were a world with no natural evil, maybe they would be worse worlds because they would have, you know, moral evil in them. So these two things sort of play off against each other. This is the question that was asked here. I mean, certainly God could create a universe with no natural evil in it. He could create a world that consisted just of a single bowling ball floating in outer space. That would be a world with no natural evil, but it would be a very uninteresting world. I mean, what we want to know is, could God create a world in which there are moral agents with free will who can create a significant amount of moral good and yet with less natural evil in it? And I think we really have no idea of whether that's feasible. And moreover, that relates to the second assumption, God might have good reasons for permitting a lot of this natural evil in a world with free creatures. And I think, as a Christian, that it's related to the kingdom of God, that God wants to bring the maximum number of people freely into his kingdom. And I don't find it at all implausible to think that natural evil and moral evil could be a part of the circumstances in which he uses to do this.
We've covered those two of the questions in terms of free will and a little bit on natural evil. What about the point over there about is God innocent and to prove guilty?
Well, that was the first question about burden of proof.
Right.
But we haven't really talked about why we believe in free will, or if we do, I don't know your position on that, actually.
Well, give my hands a long and curly tail, doesn't it? Uh-huh. We're all very familiar, since almost everybody in this world has written an essay and tried to make a question of proven determinism before now. And how long have we got? We've got a week, it's half a bank holiday weekend, stay all weekend.
And the final
I think the short answer is this, that in order to make intelligible to ourselves the idea of occupying a moral universe, that our social universe is a moral universe, that it makes sense to say to people that they will be praised or blamed for what they do, and rewarded or punished for what they do. And in order to give content to the way that we evaluate and judge actions and characters, we really need to think that it's possible for people to do other than they do when they make choices. So Brooks says that the concept of free will is essential to our thinking in terms of the possibility of morality at all. And it may very well be that the problem, this just in very shorthand, is the kind of solution that I might prefer. But the vocabulary of morality requirements, it does feel that, is an incommensurable vocabulary with respect to the vocabulary of natural law and causality, which is where the idea of determinism arises. I'll just explain that very, very briefly. Imagine you have two people standing at the side of a field. Now, one of them talks about the occurrences on the field in terms of the velocity of objects of a certain mass interacting with one another in certain ways, emitting radiation at certain frequencies, and so on. And the second person describes it as a rugby match. But it might be that in the vocabulary of the second person, the sociological vocabulary, there are terms like a goal, point, try, and scrum, and so on, which cannot be translated into any of the language of physics, and vice versa. And yet, in some respects, they're about the same thing. So a deterministic, causal, natural law account of the world, and a sociological, stroke, moral account of the world, focus upon the same thing. They're co-referential, but they differ deeply in sense because they have different purposes. That would be the answer I would give.
Now,
quite a useful one for school, I think.
I thought I was tracking with you until the rugby illustration.
It's not that.
It's that that what the illustration suggests, and what I think then you must believe, is that in fact, although morality requires the belief that we are free, you don't really think that we are, that physics will give a thoroughly deterministic and complete account of why we make decisions we do, in terms of brain waves, electricity, neurons firing, and so forth. Everything is determined, but the language of morality is just a way of talking about these in a different way, like talking about the physics of these footballers in terms of game vocabulary. And that is really a deterministic view of human beings that really says that this talk of morality is ultimately illusory, but unfortunately necessary for us if we're to act morally. Is that your view, or do you think that we really do have libertarian free will?
No, I think that in just the way that something like Carnap, for example, said, if you ask me the question, do numbers exist? I say, yes, they do. If you ask me, do tables exist? I say, yes, they do. If you ask me, do numbers and tables exist? And I say, do you mean in the same realm, in the way that tables do in the physical realm and numbers do in the arithmetical realm? Then the answer is, you're muddling two different kinds of questions. You have to believe the existence of numbers in order to be arithmetic. You have to believe the existence of tables in order to do complicated physics. And just the same way as to do morality, you have to take very seriously the idea and commit yourself to the idea that agents of free will, just as you have to commit yourself to the idea of causality when you talk about physics. So, I mean, yes, you take them very seriously. But the question of trying to reduce one to the other is precisely the source of our muddle about these things, just as they would be if you said numbers would only exist if, in some sense, they existed in the same way the tables do, or vice versa.
Yeah, I'm still not happy with that. Let me just say why I do, one reason I do believe.
And then we'll take some more questions.
Right. And that is, I think determinism is rationally unaffirmable. Because the person who finds himself believing in determinism has to think that his belief in determinism is just determined. That it's not the result of a rational process. It's like having a toothache or a limb growing out of a tree. And therefore, if you believe in determinism, you ultimately have to believe that your belief in determinism is itself determined and therefore irrational. And therefore, determinism cannot be rationally affirmed, I think. And so I'm a libertarian.
So may I just say...
Have a closing point on
this. Yes, okay. Yeah. But if you believed in determinism, which I would, but if you believed in determinism, then it would be true that you would be determined to believe in determinism. But that wouldn't be irrational, that would just be non-rational.
I think we'll close it at that point and have some more questions.
I must say, I find it terribly difficult to believe that infant... could have committed such grievous sins that it deserved being grounded in tsunami that happened recently. And so the idea of natural evil as a just punishment from God makes the idea of the being who would do such a thing even less agreeable than the former beings.
I'd like to address that first question as well, because had I had more time, in developing my third point about the probabilistic version of the problem of evil, I would have appealed to an argument, a moral argument for the existence of God, as one of the reasons to believe that God exists, that is on the other side of the scale, so that even if evil presents a certain weight against the existence of God, I think it's outweighed by these other arguments on the other side of the scale for God, and one of these would be a moral argument. And I think that evil actually proves the existence of God. I think there's actually an argument for God from evil, and here's how it would go. Premise one, if God does not exist, objective moral values do not exist. And what I mean by is objective is values that hold and are binding independently of whether anybody believes in them or not. And I think many theists and atheists alike agree on this. I could give you citations that in the absence of God, moral values become just the spin-offs of socio-biological evolution, similar to the altruistic behavior exhibited in a pack of baboons, where it's beneficial for the species to act in altruistic ways. So that apart from God, it's hard to see how you can escape socio-cultural relativism. If God does not exist, I think it's plausible that objective moral values do not exist. Second premise is evil exists. Namely, some things really are wrong, and take your list of them. From that it follows premise three, therefore objective moral values exist. Namely, some things are actually evil, and therefore, four, God exists. So if those first two premises are true, it follows that evil actually serves to demonstrate the existence of God. So while evil superficially seems to call into question God's existence, I think on a deeper level, evil actually serves to prove God's existence, because in the absence of God, there really isn't any good or evil, per se, in the universe. Could I say something about the wrath? Well, if you want to respond to that.
May I respond to that? Because yes. I think it's a very important point as well. Yes. Obviously. I think insofar as any facts about human beings, so if it's an objective fact, if the adjective objective applies here, that human beings, generally speaking, have noses and ears and things, if these are objective facts, then there are objective facts about human nature, human needs and interests, the human condition. I mean, things like, for example, human beings' need for play, for relationships, for affection, for warmth, for comfort, for security. These are all facts about human beings, which make moral demands on other human beings. I mean, if I know that you're a human being, you're a sensitive, sentient, thinking creature, and that you're capable of suffering, capable of pleasure, and I know that giving you an ice cream and taking you out of the rain and all those things will conduce to your benefit in some way, then I see that as an obligation, as imposing an obligation on me to act accordingly. Every right has as its inverse an obligation. So it seems to me that insofar as those things are objective, then there are objective moral values. Where the difference comes in between a theological conception of morality and this one is that it's possible to believe that our understanding, our insight, might mature and evolve through history. In fact, I think that theologically based morality does this too. After all, in Leviticus 22 or something like that, it says that if a man sleeps with another man or with a woman, kill him. Now, we don't do that anymore, mercifully. And that's because we've evolved our understanding of these descriptions, and so we behave differently. And so these social facts make a change even in the interpretation of theologically based morality. But it seems to me that all we're doing is we are taking a different and, I hope, more considered and mature and sympathetic view about human nature and its needs and interests, but still responding to what are objective facts out there in the world. So from that point of view, you can be fully objective in your morality without having to invoke the existence of them.
Yeah. See, I wouldn't call those objective at all. I think that's exactly the point that these evolutionists or sociobiologists like Michael Ruse, for example, are making. He would say if you rewound the film of evolution, so to speak, and let the process run again, you might evolve a very different kind of creature than Homo sapiens with a very different set of values. And for Homo sapiens to think that human beings are intrinsically valuable or have certain moral duties and obligations is to be guilty of speciesism, kind of akin to racism, favoring your own species and thinking it's especially valuable. And Ruse wrote an especially interesting article called Is Rape Wrong on Andromeda? in which he argued that while rape may be a constant in human societies as a result of our sociobiological evolution, that we could well imagine a race of intelligent extraterrestrials for whom rape was not a moral constant. And if these beings were to come to Earth and, say, began to rape throughout the Earth or maybe even use us for laboring animals or as food, as we do cattle and pigs, what could we say to them? If we said, but we human beings think this is wrong to do that, they would just reply, well, that's just a product of your sociobiological evolution. There's nothing particularly objective about that morality, and there's no reason that we should regard that as true. That's just your own speciesism. And so I don't think that that gives a really objective foundation for moral values. On the contrary, I think that's exactly what I was saying, is that if God doesn't exist, then we're just animals. We're just relatively advanced primates, and animals aren't moral agents and don't have moral duties. And I don't see that we do either. These are just ingrained to us by evolution and the survival of this species.
I agree with you that we're animals and advanced.
Oh, that's, yeah, on atheism, I said. That's not my...
I just dropped the just, you say. Mm-hmm. If there isn't a God, then we're just animals. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's fine, I mean. I think that my problem is that... just take the rape point, for example. Now, here is an historical fact about the evolution of moral thinking about rape, that it was once, and until relatively recently, thought in Catholic doctrine, that rape wasn't as bad as masturbation, because at least rape would issue in conception. So from a moral theological point of view, that there was that distinction. And of course, in the past, it was regarded as perfectly acceptable for men to carry off women if they needed a wife or were in the mood or something. There's a fragment from one of the ancient cities of Assyria saying that at a certain season of the year, no man felt like taking a woman in the street, because this was a very bad bit of news for the men of the time. That's the women of the time in mind. At any rate, there were very different conceptions of these things, and they evolved too, even in the context of theological morality. But it just seems to me to be, if it's I put the point about human possession of noses as being an objective fact about human beings in the same category as human interests, needs, desires, feelings, sentiments, capacity for enjoyment and pain, and so on. I put them on the same plane because they seem to me to be natural facts, naturalistically conceived facts about human beings. And that they provide a basis for us for thinking about appropriate responses to them. So if, for example, you saw somebody lying on the floor, wailing and in pain and everything else, and you thought to yourself, what should I do about this situation? And supposing the alternatives that presented themselves were one to go up to them and help them, and the other was to kick them, then, somehow or other, the facts about their situation seem to constrain which choice you should make. And that seems to be a very powerful basis for thinking about mutual respect and kindness.
Let me pick up on your example, because I think it's illustrative. On the atheistic view, I think it's impossible to contrast that ancient society's values with what we think today and to say that moral progress has been made, because that would be to make a judgment on their views or their attitudes compared to ours. What you can say is moral change has occurred, but it would be impossible to say that there's been genuine moral progress, because there is no objective standard by which to measure it. So, again, you're just lost in sociocultural relativism, and these ancient Syrians will say our view of sexual relations to women is different from yours, and it's just as good. In fact, what they would do, Professor Grayling, is they would look at the animal kingdom and they would say acts that look very much like rape go on all the time in the animal kingdom. If a male animal is prepared to force himself upon a female on occasion, he, as a more stronger animal, is more likely to propagate his genes and hence issue in progeny, so that he has a selected advantage by doing this. And so I think that this attempt to root moral values in sociobiology is just really horrid and ultimately leaves us, I think, with a position of saying that there isn't really any objective moral truths, and that moral progress and moral blame and things like this become just subjective and relative.
Mm-hmm. two very quick points.
Can you finish on this one?
On the business of the animal, the male animals and all the rest of it, you obviously haven't been observing how pigeons behave in the breeding season, which is very definitely the female who doesn't choose them. I used to think that I wouldn't at all mind living in classical Athens if I could take my dentist and his equipment with me.
Yes.
But then I think to myself, well, just so long as I wasn't born a woman or a slave or a non-Athenian or...
Well, and if you survived as an infant, since they practice infanticide.
Exactly. So, yes, exactly. So I think that we've made a lot of moral progress since that time. You helped me with my point.
Do you perhaps briefly want to cover the... Is God's knowledge satisfied, or his plan satisfied, in the death of atheists?
Well, I would just say that struck me as a bizarre question, and no, I don't think the knowledge of God requires the extermination of man. I want to say, though, about the God's wrath question, I don't want to back away from God's wrath. I think that God is a just and holy God who punishes sin and evil. And ultimately, this is our hope, that we do live in a moral universe after all, that evil will be conquered, evil will be punished and dealt with. But it is presumptuous on our part, any time we see an act of evil in the world, to say, oh, this is God's judgment on that person. And you're shaking your head, you probably weren't asking that then. So that's fine. I just don't want folks to think that one is being presumptuous. I think one always extends acts of mercy toward the suffering. This is our moral duty. That's, again, one of the differences between Christianity and utilitarianism. When you see someone suffer, you're not paralyzed by the consequences. That's the utilitarian who's paralyzed, because he doesn't know what the consequences are going to be. But the Christian acts on the maxim, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, regardless of the consequences.
In the interest of time, we need to move on a little bit. The galleries are very important, and we don't want to ignore them. From the top, two questions. Right, so the question, why did the tsunami happen? Second question? So it's about multiple paths of life.
Yeah.
And the question's about, will one of them reach the right goal? Is that...
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, is there one more over that back? Yeah.
I'm wondering if you could tell us more about thinking about the capability of the universe to look and touch on it.
Could God make there be no moral evil? Okay. Can you keep your comments very concise in these comments? Do you understand?
Yeah, I'll try to.
Yeah.
Thank you. I don't think that the occurrence of the tsunami was arbitrary. It happened because of the movement of the tectonic plate. The surface of the earth. I mean, there are good physical explanations as to why it happened. Sorry? Morally, obviously, yes. Morally indifferent, I think, is the term. In itself, it's just something that happened. And its consequences were very tragic for a large number of people. Tragic, but also when you think of the outpouring of sympathy and the support there was from around the world, every child, and so on. The second question was about.
It's about the multiple possibilities.
Yes, indeed. The point about that story is that it has a false premise to it, which is that it was the way the doors slid on that particular occasion that determined the two quite different narratives. But of course, the doors are always sliding, so you don't catch the train again the next day and the next day and so on. So that at every point, every node in our existence is one in which there are a large number of possibilities, as your question implies. And I think there are two things to think about. One is, as the Chinese sage Sun Tzu said, every opportunity taken is 12 opportunities made, so you know it doesn't much matter which one you take the one you make the best of it. And the other thing is that, because the idea of a human life is the idea of an attempt to impose a kind of narrative on it, a kind of story. And part of the story that a lot of people here are engaged in is finishing a degree and going on to the world of work and so on. So whether or not you miss the train that particular occasion, the super narrative might nevertheless still unfold because you've got these larger and longer intentions in play. So, I think that the idea of the arbitrariness or crucial moments in life, although certainly they do from time to time happen, it is not such a significant idea.
With respect to the question about the tsunami, I can no more answer the question why the tsunami happened than I can answer the question why did World War II happen. It would be presumptuous to think that one could answer that. But I think what one can say from a Christian point of view is that overall this fits into God's master plan of building the kingdom of God. And that in some way, these natural disasters and wars and things of this sort are permitted with a view towards God's bringing the maximum number of people freely into relationship with himself. And his morally sufficient reasons for that will be varied and multiple and maybe even centuries removed from now. And that's what the second question saw. And I'm so pleased that the second questioner was staggered by the complexity of this. Because so often students will say, well, why couldn't God just prevent this evil? Or why couldn't he just pull that out of the world? And they don't understand this inextricably woven web of contingencies to bring about the existence of a single event in history. When you trace the web of contingencies that you described in that Chinese maxim, it would require an infinite intelligence to do this. It would require an omniscient mind. And that's exactly what the theist believes God is. And there's a theory about this divine omniscience. It's called middle knowledge. If you're interested, there's a lot of stuff on my website about it. And this middle knowledge perspective says that God knows all true counterfactuals of creaturely freedom. That is to say, he knows how every free creature would act in whatever circumstances he were to place that creature in. So that given that kind of middle knowledge, that kind of omniscience, God can sovereignly direct the world of free creatures to ultimately achieve his ends, even though that may mean that he has to allow evil and suffering and so forth along the way. He is building his kingdom of God, and it will ultimately triumph. Now, with respect to the last question about feasibility, certainly God could make a world without moral evil. If he created a world in which there was no higher form of life than rabbits, there would be no moral evil in that world. But we don't know that he could create a world of significant moral agents endowed with freedom of the will, which would be a world without moral evil. Because once he creates those free moral agents, he has to stand back and let them act. Because it's logically impossible to make someone choose freely a certain course of action. It may well be the case that there is not a world involving this much moral good in it, but without also this much moral evil.
Two very quick responses, Danny. I'm not so sure about the rabbits. I mean, God has always been against promiscuity, as you know.
Oh. But he says to the animals in Genesis, be fruitful and multiply.
Well, that's one reason why I think we're animals too. One thing that was interesting about Ms. Bates' answer to the point about the complexity of the world, well, there are two things actually. One is about the place in that view of miracles, which are, as you know, wild interventions in a tremendously complex world, which presumably would change everything radically on the sort of butterfly pieces. But the other thing is that you're premising God's action in time. And I don't know what conception of God we're working with here, but one traditional conception of God is that he's eternal, he's outside time, and therefore the whole of history, from its beginning to its end, is already present in his knowledge and so on. And so the idea of him sort of working out things, let's have a tsunami after a few million years and we'll do this and so on, just to make everything work out for the good, is inconsistent with that idea.
My research project that I pursued just before my present research interest, I worked for 13 years on the question of God and time, and I published 6 books on this subject, so this is one that's very near and dear to me.
Keep it brief.
All right. My view is that God is timeless without creation, but temporal since the moment of creation. That the decision to create a world was a decision to enter into temporal relations with temporal beings, and therefore God exists now.
That's 13 books condensed. I'm sorry, but time has moved on. We have summing up speeches, and both speakers will be available afterwards. I'm sure if there are further questions, you'd like to come up and ask for a little while. But we'll do this summing up from here. but I think probably easier. So I'd like to ask both speakers, starting with Professor Craig and then Professor Grayling, to speak for up to 5 minutes, just summarizing the key points they'd like to leave us with today.
I think it's clear in tonight's debate that there is no logical problem of evil anymore, that the atheist has not been able to demonstrate that God and evil are incompatible with each other, that on the contrary, the theist can offer a possible explanation that proves the compatibility of God and evil. Moreover, I think we've seen on the probabilistic version of the problem of evil that the atheist makes enormously presumptuous probability judgments that we're simply not in a position to make with any confidence, and I gave a number of illustrations. I think as well that if the Christian God exists, then it's not at all improbable that evil exists, because the purpose of life is not to become happy in this life, and that God's purpose even spills over into eternal life. And finally, we've not looked at all tonight at arguments for the existence of God, except for that argument for the existence of God from evil, which is important. And I think when you look at, on balance, the arguments for God's existence, they make God's existence quite probable. But tonight I focused entirely on the intellectual problem of evil. And I'm convinced that for most people, the problem of evil is not really an intellectual problem at all. I think it's really an emotional problem. And so I want to ask in my closing statement, does Christian theism have the resources to deal with this emotional problem? And I think it certainly does, because it tells us that God is not a distant creator or an unmoved ground of being, but a loving heavenly Father who shares our sufferings. Alvin Plantinga has said, as the Christian sees things, God does not stand idly by, coolly observing the sufferings of his creatures. He enters into and shares our suffering. He endures the anguish of seeing his Son consigned to the bitterly cruel and shameful death of the cross. Christ was prepared to endure the agonies of hell itself in order to overcome sin and death and the evils that afflict our world, and to confer on us a life more glorious than we can imagine. He was prepared to suffer on our behalf, to accept suffering of which we can form no conception. You see, Christ endured a suffering which is literally beyond understanding. He bore the punishment for the sin of the whole world, and none of us can understand that kind of suffering. Even though he was innocent, he voluntarily took upon himself incomprehensible suffering for our sake. And why? Because he loves us so much. How can we reject him who was willing to give up everything for us? I think when we contemplate Christ's sacrifice and his love for us, this puts the problem of evil in a totally different perspective, because we now see that the true problem of evil is the problem of our evil. Filled with sin and morally guilty before God, the question is not how God can justify himself to us. The question is how we can be justified before him. So when God asks us to undergo suffering that seems pointless or unnecessary, I think meditation upon the cross of Christ can help to give us the moral strength and courage that we need to bear the cross that we're asked to carry. And I'm reminded in this connection of a woman whom one of my faculty colleagues encountered in periodic visits to a nursing home. This woman had been confined there in a wheelchair for 25 years. She was blind and nearly deaf. Her face was being eaten by cancer so that the right side of her face was dropped and she drooled constantly. Yet to his surprise, he discovered that she had a perfectly lucid mind. And he was also surprised to discover that she was a Christian. Her name was Mabel. As my colleague continued his visits to the nursing home, his attitude began to change from the idea that he was being helpful to the realization that Mabel was actually ministering to him, and he began to write down the things that she said. Well, one day as he was preparing for final examinations and his mind felt pulled in 1,000 directions at once, the thought struck him, I wonder what Mabel thinks about lying there all day. And so he went to ask her, and this is what she said. I think about my Jesus. My colleague sat there silently for a minute, and then he asked, what do you think about Jesus? And she answered, I think how good he's been to me. He's been awfully good to me in my life, you know. I'm one of those kind who's mostly satisfied. Lots of folks would think I'm kind of old-fashioned, but I don't care. I'd rather have Jesus. He's all the world to me. And then she began to sing an old hymn.
My colleague, stunned, later wrote, "This is not fiction. Incredible as it may seem, a human being really lived like this. I know, I knew her. How could she do it? Seconds ticked and minutes crawled, and so did days and weeks and months and years of pain, without human company and without an explanation of why it was all happening. And she lay there and sang hymns. How could she do it?" My colleague concluded, "The answer, I think, is that Mabel had something you and I don't have very much of. She had power. Lying there in that bed, unable to move, unable to see, unable to hear, she had incredible power." I think that although paradoxically evil is the greatest obstacle to belief in God, at the end of the day, God is the only solution to the problem of evil. If God does not exist, then we are locked without hope in a world filled with gratuitous and unredeemed suffering. But if God exists, he is the final answer to the problem of evil, because he redeems us from evil and takes us into the everlasting joy of an incommensurable good, which is fellowship with himself.
You have the last word.
My compliments to Professor Kay for his eloquence and his passion. And as regards to the story of Mabel, she sounds like a remarkable woman. She's a remarkable testament, I think, too, to the great power of human psychology. And the fact that a faith, a commitment to whatever it might be, religion or ideology, tremendously sustained, and that's a hopeful and happy fact about human beings. Although one, of course, would rather that they have rational rather than non-rational beliefs to sustain them. And that's really my main point here, since this is really about reasonableness of our outlook. With very great respect to Professor Page, I have to point out that he exemplifies that. What always troubles me a bit when I engage with people of faith, and that is that they claim to know some things. They claim to know that God is a loving Father and that Jesus suffered and all those things. And when it's convenient to know those things. So then they claim not to understand or know or to comprehend plenty of other things. They claim to say that our finite cognitive powers close off to us the reason why mysterious things happen, why there is suffering in the world, or what way to good is being subserved by it. And I think the answer comes down really to this, that the basis for a fideistic or theistic or religious viewpoint on the world is in itself not a rational one. It's a non-rational one. In plenty of cases, it's an irrational one too. Let me just remind you that until pretty recently, really, until the early decades of the 20th century, lots of people in these islands of ours believed in the existence of fairies. I mean, they were responsible for things like your shoelaces going missing and pinches and eggs and so on. And there is that story about the old Irish lady who was asked if she believed in leprechauns, and she said, "I do not, but they're there anywhere." And anyway, you know, that kind of fundamental faith in the existence of these non-natural things runs very deep in human nature. They're not rational beliefs. They're non-rational at best and sometimes irrational. And once you've accepted a belief, once you've accepted a premise, as it might be by a Pythagorean belief of faith, or for whatever reason you have it, perhaps you were brought up in that tradition, or perhaps you turned to it at the moment of crisis in your life, then almost anything follows. A belief in an omnipotent and benevolent deity, under whatever descriptions those things might have, has exactly the same logical power as accepting a contradiction does. In other words, anything follows, anything's possible, apparently inconsistent and irrational things can be reconciled and accepted in the light of their faith. Simply by moving in and out the shadows in the light, we know some things that God loves us, and we don't know plenty of other things why certain things happen in the world. And with this armoury, really, it's a rhetorical rather than a logical armoury, you can do what Professor Craig has so eloquently done, and that is you can assert a position, and then on the basis of it, you can say something which is very, very uplifting, moving to the story which witnesses to the power of that faith. But it seems to me that although it's harder and in some ways starker to try always to proportion beliefs to evidence, to look around you, to look at the world, to look at history, to look at the action in the world of those organizations and individuals who have laid claim to faith and those who haven't, and so on, and proportion one's belief to the evidence, and one takes a secular, humanist, non-religious view of the world, one nevertheless finds in it better and deeper reasons for wanting to respect one's fellow men and women, and wanting to try to do something in the world which ameliorates the harshness of things in this world. And concern for others and kindness towards them, giving them the benefit of the doubt always, because they are, like you, individuals who have needs and interests and with which you can sympathize. Those very, very simple, very deep intuitions about this common experience we have of being human in the world seems to me to be a very, very powerful source of fellowship and of morality. And one needs nothing more than that. And I've often thought to myself, if I see two people acting with concern towards their fellow human beings, and one does it just out of a sense of fellow feeling or an empathetic insight into the suffering of the other person, and the second person does it because of some ideological commitment or faith or belief or desire to, at worst, discourse other sorts of grounding points as the case might be, I find that my respect for the first person is always much greater.
This has indeed been a remarkable evening. We had high hopes for it, and those have been truly fulfilled. And I'd like, on all our behalf, to thank so much our guest speakers this evening for coming to us and leading us on an incredible grand tour of life, the universe, and everything. I especially want to thank the questioners so much as well for bringing so much out from the speakers to lead to very fascinating dialogue once we got them around the table together, as it were. But especially thank you to the audience for your energy, your enthusiasm, and your engagement. So I hope we've all found food for thought, whatever our views and opinions, in these big questions about God and meaning. Don't forget to hand in your response cards as you leave. And I hope that for Professor Craig, his Oxford experiences tonight have started to wean him from his Cambridge flirtations. And I also wish for Professor Grayling, who just signed another major book deal for some incredible tomes, that his ongoing quest for mystery, reason, and meaning, great success. Thank you, and good night.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that debate between A.C. Grayling and William Lane Craig held at the Oxford Union in 2005 on the problem of evil. And I hope it jogged A.C. Grayling's memory of the event as well. Well, if you want to get in touch in regard to today's programme, I welcome your emails, of course, as usual. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And don't forget, you can find a wealth of resources and past programmes, many debates that we do here in our studio between Christians and non-Christians. And, of course, resources, some of them Bill has contributed to in the past as well. So premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And you'll find the link there as well to the booking page and the events pages of the Reasonable Faith Tour coming up in October here in the UK. William Lane Craig will be visiting the UK for about 2 weeks, starting Monday the 17th of October. With the event in London that I mentioned at the start of the programme, he'll be debating a prominent atheist, president of the British Humanist Association, Polly Toynbee, on the existence of God at Central Hall, Westminster. I do hope you can join me for that, what promises to be a spectacular event. That's all to start off the Reasonable Faith Tour. As I mentioned, lots of other dates as well around the country. Exciting lectures, conferences, debates going on. And you can find it all at bethinking.org/Craig. And if you want to go directly to the booking page, that's at premier.org.uk/Craig. Well, I'll be back with the usual format of the programme on Saturday, the 9th of July. David Robertson is joining me here in the studio, and he's going to be grilled by several atheists who are coming on the line talking about some of the tricky questions about Christianity and about the existence of God. So if you want to hear that, Grill a Christian, I think it's the fourth edition we've done with David Robertson, who's a pastor and evangelist from Scotland and a great guy, then why not tune in here on Premier Christian Radio, or indeed via the podcast which you're listening to now. That's all to come next week at the same time, 2:30 till 4, and online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Until then, have a great week.
Before the rush takes over, start your Christmas journey with Premier's Advent Moments interactive calendar. Open each door and step into the unfolding story of Jesus with daily challenges rooted in kindness and a verse that brings you closer to Bethlehem. You'll also receive short emails of encouragement to help you stay centered through Advent. Sign up at premier.org.uk/advent2025. Brought to you by Sat7 UK.